Welcome to the Raising Your Game podcast, where I bring to you the stories, insights, and ideas from those in the world of sport to help you build a stronger mind, more resilient body, and healthier life. Whether you're an up-and-coming athlete in the making or a seasoned professional, this show promises to give you something that you can use for positive change and help you in raising your game. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Lewis Hatchett, and in this episode, I speak with John Lewis, the elite fast bowling coach for England cricket. John also played cricket himself for England, as well as Gloucestershire, Surrey, and my own club, Sussex, where he was my teammate, roommate, mentor, and a coach for my own game. A career that spanned 20 years, and he took over 1,000 first-class wickets across all formats. I thought this conversation with John was going to be good and that he would be an awesome guest. However, I was blown away at how good this conversation was. We talk about a range of awesome topics, from what it takes to make it as a top professional, how to be patient as an athlete, and why coaches should be patient with their athletes, and also leaving no stone unturned in pursuit of making yourself the best you can be. Strap yourselves in, guys, because this is an episode that I was looking forward to. But like I said, it absolutely blew me away. So without any further hesitation, I give you one of my favorite conversations so far, John Lewis. Enjoy. John, thank you for coming on, mate. I've actually had this one probably on my radar a little bit longer than you've had it on your radar. I managed to track you down from traveling around the world, and it's good to finally have a chat. How's your last, even though we just kind of spoke about it, how's the last, I guess the last 12 months been for you in the whole England setup?
Well, 12 months ago, my job, probably 12 months ago now, I'd just come back from Under-19 World Cup. We got knocked out in the round robin stage by Australia and West Indies. So we had in terms of results, had a poor tournament. We finished 10th overall, but we managed to almost, I suppose, what they call win the runners up, the plate type thing, which is a nice thing to win because it gives the lads a nice sense of achievement when they're coming home. But also it's a really not a great thing to win because you've obviously got knocked out in the rounds, in the early rounds of the tournament. So there was, during that period, a lot of learning for me as a coach and a lot of learning for the players. And obviously we came back and from there in March, April time, it was COVID time.
Yeah.
So, you know, COVID comes in and I was put on furlough for a bit. So I spent a lot of time here at home. And then I was looking at what I was doing as a under-19 coach, and I looked ahead and I thought, well, it's going to be really unlikely that there's any under-19 cricket going on in the near future at a national or international level. So I said to my direct line boss, Mo Bobat, I said to him, look, if there's any opportunities in and around the England team to help get this show back on the road, then I'm really keen to get in and get involved. Unfortunately, at the time, the staff coaches at ECB, there wasn't many of them. And so Chris Silverwood was really the only bowling coach in and around the England team. So they decided in their wisdom to use me to help get all the players back up and running from a standing start, so to speak, back last sort of May time, to get them ready to play some county cricket, and then obviously into bubble life in last year against West Indies. I think that started in sort of June, July time, and then against I was involved in getting those guys up and running, and then I was involved in getting the white ball specialist up and running, and I was involved then in directly with the white ball team over the summer, and that led on to some work with the winter with the white ball side in South Africa, and then followed on with the test team in Sri Lanka and India. So it was a very different year to what I had planned. I had planned a year around working out how to start afresh with a new group of under 19 players, and it turned out to be working with some of the best players in the world in a, such a different situation that we anyone would have envisaged. So it's been a really sort of roller coaster year, and it's ended up with me changing jobs and getting a job as I think my proper title is elite fast bowling coach.
Yeah,
with DB, which is, you know, I'm not sure what it actually means, but I'll stick it on the CV.
It's good enough.
I'll go around.
I was just thinking, how long have you been coaching? How many years is it actually that you've officially been coaching?
Coaching professionally as professional cricket. I think I've done 5, might be 6 years now.
Wow.
I forget how old I am. yeah, I think I finished playing when I was 38, 39.
Yeah.
And I'm now 45, so coming up to 46. So yeah, 6, 7 years. But I've always coached. So I've always had a really, real... a love of coaching, a love of helping players. I was brought up in a Gloucestershire team where it was all about helping your mates. And when I was a really young professional, I went and played overseas. And every time I went overseas, I coached at schools, at clubs, you know, primarily to get an income over the course of the winters that I was away. I played in New Zealand, Australia and South Africa for 5 or 6 years on the trot. And every time I went, I coached. Basically to help finance the trip. But I always really enjoyed that, so coaching young people and trying to give a bit back, and then came back to obviously that Gloucestershire team who was successful, and we talked a lot about helping our mates and coaching each other, because there wasn't, professional coaching was not as widespread as it is now, and there wasn't as much support, so you used to support each other and coach each other. So and basically I held on to that, and when I was towards the end of my playing career, I was always coaching. I was always coaching on multiple jobs in winters and stuff like that, and I was most winters I would coach if I wasn't playing or even around my playing.
That's actually that's really interesting you said that about coaching each other. I think that's super valuable. There's a funny enough, Carl Hopkinson I reckon taught me that at a young age. Obviously Carl's the fielding coach for the England team. And I think one of the things he said to me, even when he was a player, I don't think he was a coach at the time, but he said, you have to be able to, so if you're like throwing to a teammate, you have to be good at that. You have to like be able to throw, whether it's spin or something, that your ability to give good practice to your teammates, to be able to actually help them out, is going to make the team better. You shouldn't just all lie on the coaches all the time. That's a really interesting thing that you said there. Was that a culture thing that you put in?
I don't think it was intentional.
Yeah.
It was just, well, it might well have been intentional. John Bracewell, who was our coach at the time, was quite a pretty smart coach. And I think it just comes from the lack of resource.
Yeah.
And the guys, all the players wanting to improve, and the lack of coaching resource in terms of people's arms and, they didn't have one of those dog sticks that everyone uses now. We didn't used to have those. Actually, everyone used to have to throw. Or bowl to each other, or play against each other in the nets, or just even talk to each other. And that's the thing I've noticed recently, actually, with the England team, is how much they talk to each other, and how much the quality of cricket conversation that they have between each other about how to tackle situations. Their first port of call isn't the coach.
Mm.
Their first port of call is their teammate. To say, oh, how did you do that against that guy? You were successful against that person. What was your thinking there? And the coach in that scenario is used as an information gatherer and a sounding board. I mean, so my role with the bowling group would be to listen to those conversations, either at practice or in and around games, gather all that information and make sure I shared it with the whole group.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? And then also make sure that those conversations are backed up with good information, and that those conversations are relevant and valid. You know what I mean, I think, and that's the thing that I've seen, the difference between young cricketers now, really young cricketers, young Lions, and then young cricketers in county cricket, is a lot of them have become quite reliant on their coaches for time and effort, and it's almost, if the coach doesn't have any time for me, it's almost like I can't go and play the game, which for me is completely wrong.
Yeah.
Actually, you need to be able to understand how to develop yourself, and because you're the custodian of your game. And then your employer is the person who employs you to play that game and can help you and guide you but you're the one that's got to go out on the field and make the decisions and do what's required at the right time, and your coach can't be out there with you. Mm-hmm. So it's important that guys understand that. And I think the modern way is for, and I think it's some real qualities in this, is for coaches to be really, really supportive and really, really available. Whereas I don't always think that does the player the biggest amount of favours, because they don't work out the challenges and the questions that they have for themselves. So I think when you get in the middle, you've got to answer the question yourself.
So where do you think all that has come from the England team? Is that just something that they've just started doing? Is there, because I reckon a part of me thinks of the reason why some people wouldn't say it, wouldn't talk, have those discussions with each other, is because they don't want to be seen as if they don't know an answer. They don't want to be seen as if they don't have the answer. It's quite a vulnerable thing to be able to say, like, I'm struggling with this part of my game. How do you do it? Where do you think that's come from in the England team?
Well, there's two parts to that. There's the bit, like you've said, you've explained there, is like, I don't want to express vulnerability. But there also, there's the other bit where the person who's sharing the information wants to keep the information to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't want to share the information because I know what I'm doing. I want to hold on to my place. You know what I mean? So to get in an environment where that works really well is that everyone has to be really comfortable in the environment. So there has to be real trust in their captain. I think a lot of it comes from the captain and the head coach, the guys who are leading the groups, is like, okay, we're encouraging these conversations to happen, and you're going to have to trust us to not view you as someone who can't do something. All that, when someone asks for help, it's because they want to improve. And so if you've got players who are continually wanting to improve and have this, I suppose people would call it a growth mindset, and all of those the things that you hear about, these guys are talking about all the time, how do I meet that challenge? How do I make myself better to improve so I can beat that opponent? That has to come from the guys who are leading. So if you've got good leadership, strong leadership, leadership that the people, the players in the environment trust, and in Owen Morgan and Joe Root and Chris Silverwood, you've got people there that those guys trust. And that comes over time. You know, it only really does come over time, and those relationships build. And people can see that someone's expressed a vulnerability and they haven't literally got shoved out of the team. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
So you have to encourage those things. And then once you've encouraged those things to happen, you can't then push it back on the person who's done it. You know, so that comes, those relationships take time, and those trusting relationships take time. But I think what new players see when they come into the environment is they see the senior players role modeling those behaviors, and then they think, okay, well, it's okay to be vulnerable, because that player there, Jimmy Anderson or Stuart Broad, has been vulnerable and said, look, so the day before the first test against Sri Lanka, Stuart Broad spoke, actually on the morning of the first test, spoke in a small bowling group prior to the game, he spoke about his nerves and how he hadn't played for a long time, and he was worried about going into the game because he felt a little bit undercooked. I mean, and he openly expressed those things to the other bowlers that were playing that game. And so that has so when someone who's done what he's done so often and has been such a good professional and been so successful is able to express those vulnerabilities to his teammates, all of a sudden everyone has a breath. Everyone just takes a breath and they go, oh, okay, he's feeling that. It's okay for me to feel like that. And once you acknowledge those feelings and you acknowledge those feelings are okay, then all of a sudden you start to relax. And when obviously everyone knows when you play your best, when you're most relaxed and you're at least worried.
Yeah, at least anxious. Yeah, that's such a nice place for a new player to come in, because you don't want to feel like the big guys in the team. I mean, Stuart Broad is one of the best bowlers ever in England setup. So like that's so nice for a new guy to come in and be able to go, this guy's not superhuman. He's not anything he's not feeling anything that I'm potentially not feeling. And he's like, yeah, like you said, allows that breath. That's what a lovely place to be in. What would you say if you've got a team and none of these conversations are going on? And I actually think, I even think to some of the juniors that I've coached this year over the last 18 months, that you're like, have these conversations, like, yeah, stop relying on me. I think, where have you got any advice for if those are not happening?
Yeah, I think what you need to do is you need to start fostering those conversations, so, and making players feel uncomfortable, feel comfortable to be able to talk. And one of the ways I try to do that with our best under 19 players is to let them know it's okay to get things wrong. So it's actually, we're here and we're learning, we're trying to become better cricketers, we're not the finished article, this is a small part of your journey to get to where you want to get to, and we're always just looking to improve. And you can only really improve, you can improve when you get things right, but you can improve when you get you improve probably more when you get things wrong. So if you see someone getting things wrong as complete failure and you're not willing to talk about it, then you're less likely to learn and less likely to improve. So if you keep sending those messages, but also, like I said, backing them up with examples of when someone gets things wrong and then talks about it, and sharing with the group saying, look, Johnny got this wrong the other day. He came to me, talked about it. He went away and practiced, and then he got out and got it right the next time. Everyone's like, oh, okay, it's okay to do that. So it's all right. And all the other players go, oh, okay. Okay, it's okay for me to get things wrong. I'm not a complete abject failure. The coach doesn't think I'm useless. Most of my teammates don't think I'm useless, because that's probably with young players in particular where they look to the most is their teammates. And their peer recognition is so important to young players. It's a fascinating subject, and each and every, especially when you're talking about coaching teenagers and all the stuff that's going on with teenagers and how their brains are developing, etc. Yeah. You know, I mean, what they call it, the prefrontal cortex doesn't finish developing until you're 23. Some people even later. So their ability to make good decisions under pressure is really limited. Or restricted, and they don't always, they can fluctuate in their moods from day to day. So it's very, very hard as a coach to judge those guys. And patience with people of that age, girls and boys, is such an important thing when you're coaching, is that things are going to take time and kids aren't always going to get things right. And as a coach, playing out, it's hard because everyone wants to win.
Yeah,
I mean, you're playing sport to win. You're not playing. Some people play sport to take part, but most people play competitive sport to win. You know what I mean? They want to go out and they want to win. And the hardest thing is to be at peace with losing, as long as the guys are improving.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of stuff. When I went to the World Cup with them, the 19s, yes, we lost. But what I see as success is guys transitioning from under 19 cricket into first class cricket and being successful because they've learned from the mistakes they've made at that level. But you've got to be really, a really patient coach to be able to do that, because it tests you, because you're in the spotlight, you're in quite a high-profile role, everything's on TV, and you've got to answer questions, why do you win, why do you lose? And, you know, you've got to be really patient with young players.
I think you've got to be a patient player as well to do that. It's not just on the coach that needs that patience. The player has to have that patience, and also probably the families have to have that patience. I think if you're thinking from a real young, I think literally this is just ringing in what I've experienced in the last 18 months. So what I set out and said from the start was, okay, I've got this group of guys and I want to get them better. I want them in 3 years' time to be able to jump into men's cricket and men's sport, whether it's cricket, Aussie rules, football over here. I want them to go in there with some sort of attributes that allow them to get better at whatever skill set they're putting their mind to. So like I said, it can be anything. It could be business if they wanted it to be. But they had to understand that there was this, and I described it as like this seesaw of development and performance, and you very rarely got them balanced together. So if you were with development, then performance fell away. And then once you've developed and you feel confident in that skill, then you might be able to, you can put those performance, you can really focus on that performance. And it was really, really tough to convince people past, I'd say, 3 months that this is still a process that you have to hang into, because it doesn't have and also you're talking about each individual person learning in their own individual time frame. Some kids might pick it up in 2 weeks. Some kids might take 2 years to pick it up. And that is so hard to figure out how to convince people that development is, especially at this young age, is where you want to be. And I'm talking kids from the ages of like 12 to 17, eight, maybe 18. And these guys, they're learning that you're not going to be the finished product. It's so hard to convince them.
Yeah, I suppose I'm listening to you there, Hatch. So people often separate development and performance as two different things. Because actually, I tend to view them as they're together, and they're always together, because you can't get away from it. You can't get away from the fact that everyone wants to win, and you're trying to teach people to get better at winning. Do you know what I mean? So it's like so you are developing them as winners. You know what I mean? It's like, but you're right. Different people develop at different levels and different paces. But reality is that you should be trying to get them to win and develop at the same time. You know, and the guys who are the best guys do that. For some guys, it's very hard to put them both together. And I see a lot of coaches trying to separate them. I would love coaches to look at it like, let's bring it together and see if we can blend it together and use it and work all the time. All the time working together is one thing, development, performance, all the time working together. Because that's the reality of what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And even to say to a young kid, oh, you're just going to develop this thing. For the next 2 months, you're just going to develop. They go, well, I still want to win.
Yeah,
and you're like, no, develop, and they're like, no, I want to win, mate. Like, I mean,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So it's you've got to try and get it all going together. I know what you're saying, and I've heard lots of people talk about it in two different separate bits. It's that just somehow try and think about it. How do you encourage this person to keep understanding how to win whilst developing their game at the same time?
Yeah,
I talk to young players about a lot.
I think something like cricket as well allows you to have a little bit of separation if you're trying to learn a skill in another asset. So if you're a bowler, you can develop something in your batting and you can have sort of, okay, well, I'm performing pretty well with the ball, so the bat, I can actually develop something going on there, or vice versa, whatever it is. I think that's a blessing for something like the sport we play. What were you like as a young kid when you started out? I never really have spoken to you about this. What were you like? Were you, would you say, coachable? Were you eager? How did you get into the game?
I sort of fell into it, to be honest, in terms of professional game. As a young cricketer, like, and we're talking now from probably the age of 13, I played men's cricket. Obviously played junior cricket alongside that, like my local club in Swindon. But from sort of 12, 13, I was playing men's cricket. And I moved up through the ranks of men's cricket pretty quickly as a batsman rather than a bowler. Because obviously, you feel I was quite, the talent ID guys would call me a quadrant four. So my birthday is 26th of August. So I'm a quadrant four player. Wow. So I'm right at the end of the school year. I was always quite small. I'm a reasonably big guy now, 6'2", reasonably well put together. But a lot of that's come from training. But as a young kid, I was skinny, small. So my bowling, although I opened the bowling at county age group level, but most of my cricket I played was men's cricket. So my bowling was pretty innocuous at that level as a 12, 13, 14-year-old player, because as my batting was going really well and I was playing quite a high level of men's cricket at that age as a batsman. So I didn't generally bowl. I just bowled in junior cricket. I suppose, and then I got scouted by a local scout who scouted for Northamptonshire, and I went along to a couple of net trials, and they offered me a contract. I don't really know why. I must have bowled right in the nets, and they offered me a contract. I didn't really know much about it, and I was a very amateur. You know, I mean, I've been brought up in a club level, very social. And I was very amateur when I went to Northamptonshire, and I had a couple of injuries, and I had one season there, and I was released from my contract, which I'd had a little taste, and I was really gutted about. I was like properly disappointed. I thought, well, I don't really know what to do now. Didn't really have any school qualifications behind me in terms of education. I was always okay at education. I just didn't enjoy it. I imagine my teachers would say that, what would my teachers describe me? as bright but lazy, I imagine, or couldn't be bothered, which I think applies to quite a lot of young boys. Classroom learning just didn't suit me. Academic reading, I'm still not a great reader now. I'm an audiobook man, you know what I mean? I really can't sit down and read. I don't have the attention for it. And they probably diagnose me with something now these days, but I don't know what that would be, attention deficit or dyslexia or something. I don't know. But like, there'd be some sort of box that someone would want to put me in, I imagine. But I just would prefer being outside, and still do, outside playing and being around sport. I've digressed a little bit here. I don't know where am I going. I'm going, and then I actually wrote, this is how long ago it is, actually I wrote a letter to Gloucestershire to ask for a trial. And so between the point of getting released by Gloucestershire and the time I wrote a letter, I went off and played cricket in New Zealand. There was a Kiwi fella who was staying in the same digs as me in Northampton. And I was 18 at the time, and I got on a plane to New Zealand, and I stayed with him and his family, and they put me up. They were really kind to me, put me up, and they found me a job or multiple jobs within the local community in Christchurch. And I paid my own way, and I played a season of club cricket in New Zealand, and I learned a hell of a lot about how to be more adult.
Yeah,
I grew up a bit, not a lot, but I grew up a bit. I had to work, I had to earn money. I realised that I didn't really have any qualifications, and the only thing I was really any good at was playing cricket. So next time I got an opportunity, I was going to make sure I took it a bit more seriously and make sure I asked questions and I learned. And so when I got an opportunity to go and play for Gloucestershire, one of the coaches there phoned me up, and I got on the train up to Worcester, I think, to play a second team game for Swindon. I walked to the station with my bag really early in the morning, got the train, walked from the train station to the ground. I had no cash, you know what I mean? So I then played that game, and they just kept asking me back to play some more. And by the time I got to the end of that season, I was playing first team. And then I very rarely played second team after that. I probably played more second team with you, Hatch, than I had done.
Yeah, when I was starting, yeah.
I had done at Sussex, and I had done towards the end of my career than I had done really for the last sort of 20 years in between. Because when I started playing first team, I made a decision again. It's like, I'm going to make sure that I'm playing first team. I'm going to make sure I keep learning, make sure I keep asking good questions. I'm going to look around me. I had some brilliant role models in the dressing room. Jack Russell, Mark Alane, Mike Smith was a really good mentor for me. And Courtney Walsh, who I used to travel with. And I used to listen to those guys about how they played their cricket. And I used to watch them go about their business and how they practiced. I go, right, okay, those guys have had 10, 12, 15, 20 years playing professional cricket. This is how they go about it. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to watch their behaviours. I'm going to crack on, I'm going to get better. And so that was sort of how I got into it. And like I say, I sort of fell into it. There was no academies. Yes, I was a good young cricketer, but there wasn't really a pathway that everyone has now. Everything's taken care of now, really, at a young age. That players very rarely get missed, apart from if guys are really late developers.
Yeah.
It's physically, especially fast bowlers, physical late developers. I think you can miss those guys. You see bowlers come from nowhere at 21, 22, and they've just grown into themselves and become a lot more proficient at what they're able to physically do, what they're being asked to do. But they shouldn't really get missed now, because all the professional counties have links with all the minor counties, and all the best players really, they get picked up pretty quickly. And so I sort of fell into it, and that's sort of the start of my journey, really. It was a bit lucky, really, when you look back on it.
What do you think when you were first going to that changing room? Because I imagine that changing room is a lot different from what first team changing rooms look like now. What do you think the biggest thing you felt you were going to have to learn was when you started off?
I think in professional sport in particular is brutal. You get some old pros, especially at a county level, who are, I think you do a little bit less now, but certainly when I was starting, I'm very protective of their position and their job. You've got to remember it's their job.
Yeah.
So you're going into someone's office, and they've been there a long time, and they know their time will come. when they have to finish, but they don't want that to happen yet. So they're there thinking, right, this youngster, he's after my job, basically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Basically, that's what it is. And so I suppose the thing that I was looking to do was to, first of all, because the bit that I'd learned already from being sacked at Northants was this is brutal. So I got to learn how to survive. So you get in there and you go, right, how do I survive? How do I align myself with the right people to make sure that I'm in and around the decisions that need to be made about my future? And obviously, you then have to go, right, these are the people I'm competing with. And even though they're your teammates, you have to out-compete them.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That's you want to be picked ahead of them.
Yeah.
Until you get in a position where you feel really secure and you're very much a part of the first team, then it's the chance to really help everyone else grow.
Yeah.
Now, to start with, it's not right. I'm going to have to be really selfish here, and I'm going to make sure that I'm in this team, in and around this team, whilst obviously not being outwardly selfish, but inwardly selfish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You don't want to be seen as a selfish person, but you want to be selfish in the fact that I'm going to get this done for me because it's me or him.
Mm.
And that's basically how it works in professional sport. But you don't have to be a dick about it.
Yeah. That's something that I've said to so many kids that are looking to aspire to trying to make it to that next level, and I experienced it as well. Like, it's so true. You go in there and survival mode kicks in. You got to, because it's so true that when people say, like, once you've got signed that first contract, then the hard work begins. Like, it's cliche, but it's so true, because like you said, you think that you're meant to be on a team and you've enjoyed your sport growing up and you've enjoyed it with your mates and it's brilliant. You're all out there having a laugh, and then bang, it's job time. And it is actually something on the line, and someone else's job's on the line if you don't win that tournament. It has to be an element of, yeah, you're right, you have to be selfish. I sort of looked at it and was like, right, how can I personally be selfish? But also, it's very hard to feel. I guess there'll be some people that will have an internal struggle with that, where they'll struggle with thinking, well, I want to help John, but you're telling me I've got to go and do this for myself. But that is the brutality, and that's the reality of it at the end of the day.
Yeah, what you hope is that the senior players around you are unselfish.
Yeah.
That's what you hope. You go into an environment where you go and they go, all right, this is a young player, he's obviously a good player. And you hope these guys are unselfish around you and they help you through, which is what happened with me. And that's why, as I got older and as more senior player, I always wanted to help the young players. I didn't see them as a threat. I just saw them as an opportunity for me to, A, grow my coaching, but B, so again, in a selfish way.
How can you help me?
you're helping me. I'm trying to help you, but you're helping me.
Yeah.
I'm long term, but also, I lost the train of thought, but also I wanted to help the team. So they then became about the team. It's like the team needs to win. So we need, especially at Gloucestershire, we had a very small squad. We need all the players to play well for each other. So I used to try my best. You know, I probably didn't always get it right, and there'll be some young players that say, "I was that John Lewis. He was a cluster with me, and I didn't really like him that much. He wasn't very nice to me." You know what I mean? But that I'm sure there'll be players like that. But the majority, I hope, will say that this bloke helped me as I came into the dressing room.
Yeah, you can't please everyone there. You can't, because there'll be some people will get it, some people will understand what it takes, and then there'll just be other people that just don't understand it. And that's personalities. Yeah. That's just the brilliance of being in a environment that is just so, so different. Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the podcast to tell you about the Sport Yogi app. If you haven't checked it out already, this app is designed to help you as an athlete look after your physical and mental well-being. Using methods around yoga, mobility to help improve your movement, flexibility, recover and reduce injury risk, all the way over to mindfulness, meditation and breathing exercises that will help you focus the mind, all without the hippie fluff. All the sessions and future content are built towards sports people's experiences, stuff that I'm very familiar with and I'm sure you are too. So if you're interested in giving this all a go and you feel it's going to be benefiting you as an athlete, then head over to sportyogi.com where you can download the app completely for free today. You can get started on 50 plus sessions, all for free, by just signing up at sportyogi.com, or you can head over to the iOS and Android stores where you can download the app today. So just search Sport Yogi in either of those stores. Anyway, let's get back into today's episode. What did you, as you started getting older and you started going through the years and you start to play, before you start to play for England, was there a goal for England from the word go, or did it start to accumulate over time?
I think it evolved over time. When I first started, it wasn't like, I've got to play for England. Mm. I was just like, I'm playing for Gloucestershire. Wow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I remember very, very vividly having a conversation with Jack Russell, who was playing for England at the time, and he was sat there, and a couple of the lads, you know, a couple of lads were taking the piss out of him because he brought his England helmet back and he was wearing it playing for Gloucestershire. And you know, dressing rooms get a bit, you know, a couple of the boys were taking the piss out of him about, oh, you play for Gloucestershire now, where's your Gloucestershire helmet? And Jack was wearing his England helmet. And I remember I had a little dig at him, because everyone else was having to dig it in. And he pulled me to one side and he said, you shouldn't take the piss out of that, because these guys are only taking the piss out of it because they can't do it. So, but you could do it, and it's there if you want to do it. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
And so I was like, okay, I didn't remember. No one ever really talked to me about that. And then following on from that conversation, I was travelling with Courtney Walsh, and I was starting to talk to him about international cricket and what it was like playing international cricket. And then I just asked him, I said, do you think I could play? And he went, yeah, for sure. And I'm not sure whether he really believed it. He might have just been being nice. But when he said, yeah, for sure, I was like, okay, well, that's two blokes who play international cricket and think that I can play international cricket. So I'm like, well, I might as well give that a go, because I'm all right. I'm playing for Gloucestershire now. I'm really playing pretty consistently for Gloucestershire. I look at all the other players around the country. I see what they do. I match up quite well to those guys. Those guys have been talking about playing for England, so why can't I be? Mm. You know what I mean? So then that was starting to be the forefront of my mind. How do I improve to play for England? So when I go back to what we started talking about, improvement mindset, growth mindset, the thing that I think was my greatest asset as a cricketer was about my resilience and my ability to look forward and try and improve. I very rarely look back on games. I learned from them quickly. So I'd literally learn from them on the night or the day after. And then I'd put that game in the bin. I'd go, right, next game. How do I get better for the next game? Mm. And then how do I get better for the next season? What is it I need to do? How do I improve? What is it? And all the time, every winter or every game, I'd be looking, right, I need to get better all the way through. I'm never about maintenance. It was almost always about improvement. And I think that was my greatest strength as a player. There's always a way I can improve and get better, probably right until the end. And even at the end, I was thinking, I remember going to Spain with you guys down at Desert Springs there, bowling there. And I still like competing with Mags and the other bowlers there. And it was about, right, I can be better than him. You get 70 wickets a year. My career is going this way. Can I just have one more push? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, we roomed over there, actually. We roomed
yeah,
over there.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
You had to put up my snoring.
Yeah. But did you, when you're trying to play for England, like, did you notice something that you needed to get better at? Or were you like, I've just got to continue doing what I'm doing? Or was there something you're like, oh, I've got to break this down. I've got to actually, this is the thing that's going to get me in the side.
The thing that I think made the biggest difference was my mentality. So my performances used to yo-yo quite a lot as a young player. So I'd have some really brilliant performances, but then they'd be followed by dips in performance. Through a season, I'd go like that a lot. So I'd still get my wickets. I still get, you know, maybe my 50 wickets for the season, or 50, 60 wickets for the season, and play my one-day cricket. But my performance used to go like this. And I didn't always get in the Gloucestershire team and the one-day team. So I was always pushing to get in that side and become a mainstay on that side. The one-day side was so successful. I was in and out of that side a little bit. So a lot of the skills, I remember a game we played at Worcestershire again really clearly. I think I got 3 for 20. I came off, myself and Mike Smith, the left-arm swing bowler, he got two for 15, and I got three for 20. We bowled him out for like 19 in a B&H game. And I came off and sat on the balcony, literally. And I thought I was amazing. And the coach at the time, John Bracewell, he started having a go at me about how I was bowling. And I thought he was joking. I was like, mate, you're taking a piss, mate. I've just got three for 20. I'm buzzing today, mate. I'm the business. You know what I mean? He's like, John, you're bombing on length for one day cricket. I'm like, what? Shut up, mate. And I remember I was literally fobbing him off, like laughing at him, thinking he was taking a mickey at me. And he was deadly serious. And he said to me, if you bowl that length again in a game plan for us, I want you to bowl this length. You bowl that length again, you won't play until you learn to bowl that length. So next go, I went out, did exactly the same as I did the week before. I got two for 40 or something, up 10. And I continued to bowl the length, and I didn't play for a year.
Wow.
I didn't play for the next year. Right? And he said, remember the conversation, that's what I want you to do. So you can't bowl your four-day length, your full swingy length, playing one-day cricket for this team. You're going to have to change your length. And until you understand that, until you're able to do it, you won't play on this team. I thought I should play. The performance was really good. I didn't play. We played someone else. We bowled that length. And when I got back in the team, funnily enough, I changed the length, I bowled.
Yeah.
But to be fair to him, he really praised me for that.
Yeah.
Outwardly in front of the team, you know what I mean? So that was really good coaching.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he wanted me to do something. He saw, and looking back at it, it was a real shift in how I bowled in one-day cricket, and it really improved my one-day bowling.
Were you, that must have been a bit of an internal torment, because you were trying to go, well, I'm successful at doing this, yes, and you're trying to tell me to change this, and you've got almost zero proof on it right now.
Well, I didn't understand. That's the bit I just didn't understand why he was saying it. I think if he'd explained it a little bit, or maybe if I was open to listening to it a bit more carefully,
yeah,
I was going to say if he'd framed it differently. But actually, with my coaches, if me as a player was more open to listening to what he was going to say and understanding why he was saying it, then I would have shifted more quickly. But again, a little bit of stubbornness, and the fact that I was being really successful in four-day championship cricket and successful in one-day cricket, I didn't see why I had to change. But then when I did change, as soon as I changed, I understood why. And I understood what his reason was. And then once he'd given you some praise for doing it, he was like, look, I've been trying to get you to do this for so long. And then now you've done it, and look at the result. You know what I mean? Right? And it was like, right, penny drops, goof, I understand.
Yeah.
Now it's how I understand playing one day cricket now.
So it's just about being a bit open.
Yeah, just being open as a player, which is at times, especially when you're being successful. And I was being pretty successful. I might have even been selected or been on the verge of selecting for 18 tours and stuff like that. I was like, I don't need to change. What's he talking about?
Mm.
But then I got it. Eventually I got it, and it improved me a lot as a bowler.
And you think that was one thing that helped you get into the England team? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So that change of style, change of length.
Just being control my length.
Yeah, we'll just control my length a lot better. It wasn't a lot. I was only able to move my length back maybe 2 yards or a yard and a half.
Yeah.
So I was hitting the slice of the bat rather than the middle of the bat or the middle edge of it. So I was always trying to get a nick off a drive.
Yeah.
Rather than a nick off a splice length.
Yeah.
He said, well, you just got to hit splice length more often, because if the ball doesn't move, someone will get on top of you and the ball, they'll ping you and you'll eat more runs. And so that, combine that with the ability to change my pace a bit more and bowl that change of pace a bit more, then, you know, I think that my runs per over went down a lot. I might not have taken that many more wickets, but I was probably going at 4.5 an over. And then I was going down to 3.5.
Yeah, wow.
You know what I mean? So you're going down from 45 to 35. That's how the game's changed.
So if you're around like 5 or 6 now.
If you're going under 6. So we used to go, a really good day was under 30. An okay day was under 40. If you went over 40, you're getting smacked.
Yeah.
In 10 overs. You know what I mean?
That's a good day out now.
What are you doing, mate? Now under 50 now is like you're the most amazing bowler in the world.
Yeah.
But even if I have a look at my international numbers, I think I was going under 5 and over.
Yeah.
In international cricket, international one-day cricket, which, you know, is reality now. That's ridiculous. That's how much the game shifts. Yeah. And I think that's one really important thing to understand as a coach, is that the game isn't the same as the game you played, and you've got to shift with it.
Yeah.
And the game is a lot easier when you're watching than when you're playing.
Yeah.
Remember how hard a game it is. Yeah. Because there's so many times I hear coaches going, why isn't he just doing that? Or why isn't he just doing that? I've done it myself. You know what I mean? I've done it myself. And I'm like, what's he doing? He should just do this. You know what I mean? Can he not just do that? And I hear catch myself doing it, and I'm like, no, you've got to be able to, you've got to be able to understand that the game is a lot harder when you play it than when you're watching it.
Yeah, yeah. I that actually is such a good point. I've caught myself trying to saying things like that and going, hold on, I'm still playing. Like, I understand actually what you're going. There's a million and one things going on in your mind, and more than often not, actually not necessarily a million and one things. You're actually just zoned in on one thing, and you're just like, I can't let go of this thing right now, and I've got to I can't think spatially or whatever it is that's going on. And that's actually a skill you have to try and learn, I guess, at some point. You mentioned something when we roomed together, and I remember this so vividly. There was a day, and I'd really be interested to see if you still speak about this way of thinking, or if you still think about it. Remember you were actually transitioning into, I think, coaching on that trip. You were still playing, but you were definitely taking on a coaching role at that stage, and the way you were mentoring us. And you sat us down as bowlers, and I think you asked us at the time, like, how many first class wickets have I got? And everyone's like peeling off your numbers, like, it's 849, isn't it? I've actually looked that up, because I'm like, I've got to do the maths on this. Now,
I'm thinking, what did I say?
No. So you said it was 849 wickets that you took, and you asked us, you went, how many fifers do you reckon I've got? And you class a fifer as your day, really. If you get a fifer, five wickets in innings, like, that's a good day, essentially. That's been John's day. And we're like reeling off, like, it's got to be 100, John. It's got to be 80, somewhere around 80. And it's 35. And then you said, well, out of all the wickets I took, 35 fifers, that meant 4% or just over 4% of my game wickets I took were like my day, was my day. So it's all about, what do you do on the other days? How do you just continuously, rather? And you were talking about those peaks and troughs that you had, those ups and downs, and you'd have like days where you did really well and you drop off. And that for me was a massive penny drop for the way I went about my game, because I was like, well, you can have the intention to walk out onto the field every day and take a fifer, score 100, get a hat trick in a game of football, get 5 tries in a rugby match, whatever it is, you can have that intention to be that, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not always your day. So when you reckon, how quickly can you recognize your role changes within the day? And you actually may play a supporting role. All you have to do is just get one or two and just tick over to get to the next game, because essentially the stats say that the next few more days or games, one's going to come if you just keep going. So yeah, that whole story that day resonated with me so strongly, something that I've passed on to others, because the idea, I think where it helps people is when they fail. And when they don't have that success, and they don't have the day where they're the one getting the accolades, they're the ones on the paper or just being patted on the back. So yeah, but I don't know if you still think like that.
Interesting. Yeah. So I obviously had a point. I'm glad it wasn't just about me and all my wickets and my fibers.
<Yeah. laughs> Gather around, boys. I've got a story to tell.
Real off a story about me telling everyone how good I was.
Yeah.
I suppose it's what I was trying to explain, I suppose, during, in my head, is about managing your own expectations.
Yeah.
And understanding that you turn up to the ground, and of course you turn up to the ground, and you want to take 10 wickets. You want to take every wicket.
Mm.
But if your expectations are like are that high, you're always going to walk away from the game disappointed. Mm. And geez, that's going to be a tough life as a professional player playing day in, day out. Every day you're going to walk away disappointed, rather than looking at every day as oh, I've done my job today. What is my job today? What does the team require from me now, today, to do? And, you know, when it's your job with the new ball, each spell is about, if you can take one wicket in each spell or restrict runs in each spell, I mean, the teams, you've done a good job for the team. Mm. And so you might bowl a five over spell. And if your only aim is to take one wicket in that spell and restrict the runs as much as you possibly can and control the batsman, you're doing a great job for the team. You know what I mean? But if your expectation is to come and take every time you grab hold of the ball, it's like, I should be getting this guy out every ball. You're going to walk away from almost every ball disappointed.
Mm.
So the statistics of the game that we play are that if you control an area on the pitch with the ball, if you're accurate enough to be able to bowl at an area on the pitch and move that ball, the statistics of the game tell you that you will be successful over time. You might not be successful that day because the batsman might have his day and he might nick a few, two drop catches, one inside edge past the keeper, you know what I mean? You might bowl those same balls the next day and you might get three wickets with those same balls. You know what I mean? So the game tells you, from as long as the game's been played, controlling your length and controlling your line with some movement at decent pace, you will always get wickets.
Mm.
So that's the game. Because all the best bowlers have done it. They've just done it more often and probably a little bit quicker.
Yeah. So I was going to say about when you've stepped into the England team and you've got Broad and Anderson, you've got England's two best bowlers. And what have you found? Do they have expectations of what they do? What do you believe has allowed them to be so successful for so long compared to the everyday, well, I say every day, the every other professional that's kind of played the game?
I suppose the first thing to say, everyone always lumps Broad and Anderson together.
Yeah. I think they're very different
people, and they're very different bowlers. I mean, and I think and there's always partnership. Everyone talks about McGrath and Warne, Greenidge and Haynes, Ambrose and Walsh, Eunice and Wackar and Wasim, and their uniqueness is what makes them a great partnership. So the way they are, if they were both the same, they wouldn't be a great partnership.
Yeah.
Their differences is what make them a great partnership, I think. But what they both are is great competitors.
Mm.
So if I'm watching young bowlers, I'm looking for athletic ability, competitiveness, fun, enjoyment, those sorts of things. Before I look at their technique, so I'm looking at guys who are like, okay, can they move? Are they natural? Are they competitive? Are they competing? And then do they understand how to get people out?
Mm.
And I think those are the things that those two guys have got. They understand how to get people out. And geez, they're competitive. Like, Jimmy Anderson is an absolute perfectionist. And he competes and competes and competes. He competes in practice. He competes with himself. He competes with the batter. You'll compete in anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. And Stuart Broad the same, but in a different way. No, Stuart is much more, he wants to compete on the field. He's not so that much interested in competing in practice. Or if you do go to practice, you've got to make sure there's some competition there for him, so it stimulates him. Whereas Jimmy's very different, and they're very, very different people. And then obviously you have to coach them differently. And because they're different people. And it's, I suppose, but also with the guys who have played that much to that level, you've got to keep challenging them, but within reason. You know what I mean? And at the right, and I think the most important thing is at the right time. Because they're well within their rights to say, coach, do one. I'm not interested in what you've got to say right now. I know what I'm doing. I'm just going to get on with my business. But at the right time, again, like I say, when you feel that there's an opening to have a conversation about how to improve their skills, because they want to improve. That's, again, something that stands out about both of them, is they still want to improve. There's still ambition there. As soon as that ambition stops, I think they'll both know that's the time for them to stop. But right now, geez, they're both competing as hard as ever. They both want to be as best they can. They both want to improve all the time. And there's always something they're trying to do. So that those are the things you always look out for in great players.
Yeah. It also must be quite nice you get to work with Joffre as well, quite a bit, considering your history with him. And for people that don't know, you actually housed him for...
He rented a room. I was his landlord.
Yeah. How long did you have him? You had him for quite a while.
Year and a half, 2 years maybe.
Yeah. So, I mean, his journey's been mad from when he first turned up.
Yeah, I first met Joffre in the clubhouse. And I think everyone who's been to Sussex has stayed in the clubhouse.
Yeah, you have.
Down by the cook's arms there at home. And he came down, he was cooking some sort of chicken or fish or something. I know he's cooking chicken or fish or something. But it was like literally Findus out of a packet. And I think he burnt it. And I was like, mate, have you got any idea how to cook this? And he was looking at me like, didn't say much. And I was like, and then eventually he came back over time. And you know, I actually suggested to the club. And there was a benefit to both me and to him. Obviously, it helped pay for me to be able to work down in Sussex, to have guys living with us. Obviously, for him and Delroy Rawlins, the guys who are from the Caribbean, away from their families, to be in and around a family, I think, and to have the support of people around them at home, I think is really important, because you can get lonely away from home. You know what I mean? And I hope that he feels that we helped him settle in Sussex and helped him feel comfortable and able to fit into the environment there. The thing that you know about both those lads is that I know about both those lads from living with them is they're both good people. So to reconnect with someone who's obviously a fantastic cricketer, but also a good person as well, is good fun for me. You know what I mean? It's nice to be involved in anyone's journey, but to have people in your home and to support them in more ways than just around the cricket ground, I suppose creates a much more trusted relationship. And to have, I wouldn't say that I have, over the recent times, I've really helped Joffre improve, but I know that when he needs me to help him improve, he'll feel comfortable coming to talk to me about it, which he may not do. We talked earlier about vulnerability, and Joffre in particular isn't a great one for expressing any vulnerability. However, if there's a time that he does feel vulnerable and he needs help, he knows that he can trust me to help him. I think, you know, I hope. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I suppose that's the nice thing about that relationship in particular, is that I try and make all the players that I coach feel like that. That they can trust me, and that I'm trying all the time. My intention is to help them as players and as people, because I think that's important as well. So I hope that all the players that I've come across and coached feel that way, but that may necessarily be true. But what I'm hoping more with Joffre is obviously that's gone a little bit further than that, because he was in our home around our family.
Yeah, and that trip, I mean, I've had that I've essentially been on Joffre's end of that stick, being in Australia. And you did it when you went to New Zealand, like when you're 18 years old, you're miles away. I remember that first night of being traveled that 10,000 mile trip, and you're literally, I was housed by another family, and they were my surrogate family out here in Adelaide now. And I remember just lying in their spare bedroom like that first night, just like, shit. And that was I am miles away from anything. I've got nothing. And that was where you grow up. Like, you actually learn the ways, like you might learn cooking. You might learn how to actually get somewhere on time. You might learn anything. But I always encourage that whole getting out there, travel at a young age and try and throw yourself into that deep end. And it's lovely if you have got someone there that can support you and just point you in the right direction every now and then. It's nice that you were able to do that.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm just reflecting on what you said there, Hatch, is that if you don't try, you'll never know. So there's young people out there who are worried or anxious about about thinking, oh, could I do that? I'm not sure I could do that. Well, if you don't try, you don't go and have a go, you'll never know. And like I keep saying, like I said to all the young players, you get it wrong, it's okay. No one gets it right. There's no one person that's got every decision in their life right.
Mm.
It's like parenting. Parenting's bloody hard. Mm. And no one gets it right all the time. And people who think they do, they're kidding themselves.
Yeah. That now reminds me of something that I wanted to talk about, which was you were the person, obviously with what I'm doing now, working with yoga and mindfulness and meditation for athletes, and you were the first person who actually pushed me in the direction of going to try yoga. And I remember the reason why you said to do it, and it was kind of aligned with when we had a psychologist around the team at the same time, I think, and you said, well, why wouldn't you? Why would you not leave a stone unturned? Why would you leave a stone unturned? Why would you not try? These things are there to help you. And I just always remember you having that mentality of being able to go and try something, and if it didn't work, that's fine, but it at least you tried. At least you gave something a go. And even if it is something different, if it is something that is unique, and I've even picked up on it in the way you've been talking about your coaching, like just trying something, going and learning something new, you never know when you may actually need it later on in life. You might not need it right now, but it could be something that you later on need. I think that's something that you've definitely, one, taught me, but I think is so valuable for people to understand that if you're going to try something, get somewhere with what you do, don't leave a stone unturned. Try everything that you possibly can to get yourself in that best place.
Yeah, I remember that conversation we had. The reason I remember the conversation is because of obviously what you've gone on to do.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And what I really love about what you're doing is again, you're going out there and you're pushing yourself out there, and you're going, right, I've got to work out a way. I can't play cricket anymore. I've had an injury. I can't play anymore to the standard that I really wanted to play. Mm. But I'm going to go and try and do something else. And I really love that in you. I love the way you've branched out and you've gone, right, I'm going to go and try and do something. And you did it and you thought, I really like this. And then you carried on and you've made it into something that you loved doing. And you're clearly really passionate about it because you continue to go and do it. But I tell you the reason why I suggested it for you, because I thought, what I was watching you train, and I was watching you practice, and I was watching you prep for games, and I was like, Jesus, guy, he is intense.
Yeah.
He is just nice. So I'm like, this guy just needs to calm down and breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was watching you do it, and you were trying so hard. And I was like, "This, like, you couldn't have tried any harder to be the best professional cricketer you could possibly be. And I was like, how could I get this guy just to relax a little bit and to breathe and to think and give himself some space to just calm down a fraction, so hopefully when he goes on the field, he's able to breathe and he's able to breathe and just to play. And so I thought, because I did a bit of yoga towards the end of my career and I found it really, really useful. I still do a little bit now, not as much as I probably should, coach. But I do. And I do find it to give yourself that peace and that space, just a bit of time for you, and that you're only, the only thing you're doing is for you. You're not thinking about anyone else or what anyone else is doing. That time for you is invaluable. And so just to give yourself, to prioritize, whether it's daily or every second day, some time, some space to be able to just breathe. And everyone will have their own way of doing it. At the moment, I'm into getting out on my bike, and I'm doing quite a lot of that. And so every couple of days I go out for a couple of hours, and I really enjoy the exercise feeling, but also I enjoy the fact that I can only really think about riding the bike.
Mm.
So I love going on holiday. I love skiing on holiday because you can only really think about where's my next turn or who's in front of me that I'm not trying to crash into or stop, fall over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't think about all the other stuff that goes on all day in your brain. And I think that was my intention when I suggested it to you, was to try and give you space to just calm a fraction, because I was seeing a young man so desperate to succeed that sometimes you just got to give yourself a chance to stop and reflect and think and go, okay, I'm all right at this. I just need to just be a little bit better, not just not that far away.
And really, it worked. Like, for me, it did work. It gave me that space. I saw an upward curve, and then unfortunately, the injury happens. And that, but that was on an upward curve at the time. So I know it had an impact, and I know almost within my mind, I was much more at ease with things, and I was much more comfortable in sort of my own skin. And I think initially, I was trying so hard to just do well. And I was in, again, that survival mode. I think I was just like, where can I grasp the next rung on the ladder, and I'll fight to get it somehow. But it did give me that space. And it's something that I think is super valuable for young people to be able to do that now. Because I think, geez, social media wasn't even what it was like now. There's a million and one distractions compared to that. They're amplifying the smallest problem, and it's making it harder. Do you see that sort of thing with even the guys at the next level up, the top level?
The top level guys are more in control of sort of stuff. They're like, they're very clever about how they use social media. Some of them, not all of them.
Yeah.
The guys that I worry about more are the young players coming through now. My observations around our best young players is there seems to be a thirst or a need for recognition rather than a thirst and a hunger for learning and performance, which then will bring that recognition. It's almost like the recognition is more important than the performance or how the team plays. You know what I mean? So that their own personal stuff gets ahead of how the team, how important it is to do the job for the team. So that's my concern with how people use or how influenced they are by social media now, how everything is sort of false. There's a false, and everything's either false or it's one perspective right at the one side or the complete pendulum at the other side, where reality is most people live pretty much in the center.
Yeah.
With their opinions pretty much in the center. They're either center right or center left. We're getting a little bit political here. Most people just live around there, the majority, they live around there. But all the opinions are either this side or that side. And that's the same with someone's cricket. You never get a message on Twitter or Instagram saying, oh, well done, that was a pretty solid but average sort of day today, mate. You got a couple of wickets. I thought the two wickets you got were really nice. But then there's a couple of balls you didn't bowl very well. It's either you were brilliant or you were crap.
Yeah,
there's nothing. Yeah. Nothing sits in the middle. There's no like, well done, good day on a day where it's just mediocre. And it's similar. It was similar with so Graham Thorpe gave me a great piece of advice when I first joined the England cricket setup. He said, "Don't read the press," because he said, "You'll get 7 for 50, and you'll have your best ever day, and you'll read through every bit, every paper, and there'll be one comment from one person somewhere that says that you weren't that great." It was like, so don't bother. There's no point. Yeah. And it was easy then because it was just a paper.
Yeah.
But then the hardest bit was your family would read the paper and they would talk to you about it. So they're the people that it affects. But now, because everything is so accessible and it's there in front of you and it's addictive, you just read it and you read it and you read it and it can affect you. So I it really concerns me about, especially our young players, this generation growing up with social media rather than the guys who are a bit older, say 27, 28 to 30 year olds. I think they can manage it better. The guys below that 25 and under who are growing up with it. Now, I think it's an issue that they have to understand how to deal with it.
How do you foresee them having to deal with it, or what? How do you think the best way for them to deal with it and sit in that space? Because the whole thing is designed to give you that recognition, and it's designed to draw you in. I'm a big believer in, and I understand how I use my social media. So I use it. So I basically break it up and like, am I watching this for education, entertainment, and really, I guess, in information. So like learning something as well, again, kind of linked with education anyway. And I think it's trying to invoke an emotion and understanding why you're engaging with that emotion. Like, how does it make you feel about yourself? So is that bit of social media that you're viewing, is it designed to make you better, or is it really making you feel worse? Because you can also, the algorithms are built to show you more of what you like. So if you like learning about physics, it will show you all the physics you want. If you're looking for the best people who are having their best day holidays or whatever, then it's going to show you that as well, and you're going to feel crap because you're not on holiday.
I think the way you've explained it there is a really good way of explaining it to young people.
Mm.
Like, as soon as you move from education or gaining knowledge to looking at yourself, you know what I mean, or self-gratification or whatever it is, or self-recognition, whatever it is you're looking for, then I think that's... But you've obviously got a handle on that, and I do exactly the same. I use it, but I don't use it for me. I use it to learn, and I use it to read, and I use it to gather information. So I think if the way you've explained that is fantastic, and it's probably a really good way to try and get young people to use it. The problem being is that they've been on it for such a long time, by the time you get in contact with it.
Yeah.
It's a habit, it's ingrained.
Yeah.
It's an ingrained habit, and it's you know, I'm not going to sit here in front of me. This thing's pinging at me, and I look at it, you know what I mean? Like, rather than just turn it over, put it to the side, because I'm having a conversation with you.
Yeah.
So it's just a distraction.
Yeah.
So you've got to understand how you use it and how it affects you. But that generally, we already talked about teenagers not being able to control emotion, that sort of stuff. And we've all talked about not being able to make great decisions. We've talked about that sort of stuff, and it doesn't surprise me that they're the ones probably most affected.
Yeah, I think that's where actual, like, my mindfulness practice really helped me, because just all it's giving you is the understanding of, where's my mind at right now? And it's not telling me to do anything else. It's just, where is my mind engaged right now? I can be on my phone and I can be mindless, but I actually, can I recognize that I'm on that? Oh, okay, I've caught myself. Because you can very easily not catch yourself. You can very easily not catch yourself, and then the next hour's gone, and that's it. But mindfulness, the practice of just doing it, practice of being mindful, just allows you to throw in that break. Just put a little bit of spanner in the spokes real quick, and then stop everything going and that wheel turning too fast. And then you can catch it. And it doesn't mean it's not going to turn again. It doesn't mean that you're going to get back on it. It just means that next time it happens, you become aware of it. Okay, I'm not doing what I want to do. And then you add the time spent where you've caught yourself up, you've become more focused. You've become more focused at what you're doing, and you're engaged in what you're doing.
For sure.
Yeah, I think the confidence thing is the tough one for the kids as well. Like, it's just going to rip their confidence away. And that's what I see. I think, and self-belief, I think sometimes they believe they can't get there. They see someone that's got there. And I even had someone just message me today, like, how can I build my self-belief up? And I get the exercise that I've given people for building their self-belief up, or their building their self-confidence, is one to think of, like, when they were confident. Visualize when you were last confident, when you did something. It could be as simple as you opened up a jar and you felt confident opening up a jar, whatever it is. But you've embodied that feeling of confidence. Then the next thing is actually where you want to be. So it could be you in 2 months. It could be you in 2 years, 10 years. And then, what does that person look like, and how do they look, act, and sound? And then from that, are you acting like that person? Do you have an understanding of... But even if you don't know, you've now highlighted what you want to look like, and you can compare it to where you are now. And you can see, right, these are the things that I've clearly gone away from. So when I was confident and where I want to be, and at least you've just brought your attention to the fact that, okay, these are areas I want to work on.
Yeah. For me, confidence comes from competence.
Yeah.
So, if you're competent at something, you grow in confidence. If you're not very good at something, it's very hard to be confident at it. But then you've got to understand, and then so the reality is this is reality, this is where I'm at now, this is what, like you talked about there, this is where I want to get to, and what does progression look like? So if you take your jar opening analogy, it's like, well, progression looks like I can turn it a bit further. I've gone, I've worked on my grip, I can turn it a little bit further, but I still haven't opened it yet. You know what I mean? So, and then, oh, okay, well, go away, make my grip stronger. Oh, I can turn it a bit further. You know what I mean? Like that's, and then all of a sudden, oh, I've made my grip really strong. I can open the jar. But you've got to understand understand where, what reality is and where you're trying to get to, and then understand what progression looks like, and understand that progression can go backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. It can be regression, but you have to learn from that regression to progress some more. I mean, and then all of a sudden you become confident.
Yeah.
Because you can do it.
Yeah.
If you do something, it's very hard to be confident in that habit.
And you build that motivation.
You see people who can't do things who will outwardly look confident, but as soon as you put them under pressure, they fall.
Have you come across people like that?
Loads of people. That's your bully type. Bravado, walk tall type person, big puffer chest out type person. And then all of a sudden you put them under pressure and they go quieter and quieter and quieter. Their body language gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and all of a sudden they fall. You know what I mean? So
what about people that have made it to the top and you feel like they're... Because I've seen people that have got to the top sometimes and they probably haven't been challenged on their way up there yet. And then they've got to the top, they've got to, let's say, first-class cricket in our instance, and they get first-class cricket and then, bang, finds them out. It just catches them. There you are.
But that, the understanding, so I suppose the understanding you have is that isn't the top.
Yeah.
So they think that's the top, but reality is the top is being the best in the world across all conditions, home and away. So that's the top. You know what I mean? So... if someone thinks that the top is getting into first class cricket, they're miles away from the top.
Yeah.
So if they're like, this is my Everest, I've got it. Then of course they're going to fail because they won't try to keep improving.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. It's true, mate. We've gone over an hour. This is awesome. Time. Yeah, we've gone. It's been an amazing conversation. One thing I had that CBD sent over to me recently, and you pushed me onto the CBD. I felt all right on it. Yeah, it's not been too bad. I've only been doing it, I'd say, maybe a week. Yeah. That little tablet before the day, and then the little dropper before not bed. My sleep's feeling good. Sleep is feeling good. That's for sure. I want to get back in a gym. That's the one thing I want to do. I want to get back in and lifting some sort of weights and having that real like DOMS feeling and see how it goes there. And I've pulled away from a bit of running recently. I went a bit mad on running, and I thought I'm going to play cricket and I'll get through the season. But I want to test it. I want to see how it goes under a bit more strain. How have you felt with it?
So recovery in particular. I've found this great. I agree with you. It's helped me sleep. But what I would say is I'd give it a month.
Yeah, okay, right.
So it takes quite a while to get into the system. If you take it regularly for a month, I've been taking it now for 6-8 months, maybe a bit longer now, 9 months. And my recovery from exercise, I just don't get the DOMS.
Yeah, right.
I'll go out and I'll ride hard, like on the bike for 2 hours. Probably do 2 hours about 60k on the bike. Like, so I'm riding pretty hard for someone of my level. You know what I mean? I'm an amateur cyclist, but I ride pretty hard and as hard as I can. And I get off the bike and my legs will be like. Sometimes I'm like, oh, that was hard. I've been working really, really hard. And I'll expect to get up the next day feeling stiff and sore, and I don't.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I could go again next day. I generally don't. I generally go two days a day in between to space it out a little bit. But if I wanted to, I feel like I could get up and go again as hard the next day.
Yeah.
And it was during furlough time that I started running. And I just couldn't run. It was just too sore. I started taking the CBD stuff. And it's worked really, really well for me.
I'm excited to see. Pure is CBD. That is the one we've been using. It's good. It's a nice brand. It seems like it's got it all sorted out. And I'm really excited if it does go into sport.
I think that's the thing that's really good about that brand in particular is it's 100% synthetic. So there isn't any of the what they call THC, so which is the hallucinogenic part of cannabis. There's none of that in it. So they've taken it because it's 100% synthetic.
I was going to say.
Yeah, there's none of it in there. So it's...
Cool. I think that's what people get hung up on, don't they? I think that's the thing. I was just going to say, like, that's the thing that people get hung up on with CBD, they think, is cannabis. So it's good to know that that is... That's the thing about this one.
That product in particular has no THC in it. And it's the only product on the market at the moment that has government approval. It's gone through all the testing. It's the only product. For me, it feels like a really safe product to take.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That was the attraction. I think that comes to the sportsman in us making sure that what we're taking is the right thing. And like I said, I think it's going to be real interesting if it gets into sport. That would be lovely to see it get into sport and see it.
It sounds like some of the golfers in America have started taking.
Right.
I saw that Phil Mickelson had been taking some recently, promoting it. So there's different sports have different drug codes, don't they? It's the fact that there's no CBD, no THC in it means that it's safe to take for sportsmen, but it's not on the approved list yet. I think the company are working really hard to get it on the approved list. So over time, we'll see what happens.
Be great if they can. Be great if they can and see it go. Mate, look, I'm going to let you go. You've given me more than enough of your time today. That's been amazing. It's been awesome chatting. I've loved this. Cool. I think
good
some of the stuff...
You,
yeah, you too. I'll hopefully see you when I'm back in the UK. I'm back in the UK pretty soon. So hopefully I'll catch up with you. If people want to reach out to you, you're on Twitter. So you're at JohnLou800.
That's it, yes.
Easy. So people can find you there. Mate, have a great rest of the day. And thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure, Hatch.
This episode is brought to you by Sport Yogi, the app for athletes to build the connection between body and mind. Using methods such as yoga, mindfulness, mobility training, breathing exercises, and much more, the Sport Yogi app will help you at becoming a better athlete every day. To sign up now to your free account, head over to www.sportyogi.com or head over to the iOS or Android stores where you can download the Sport Yogi app completely free today. If you're part of a team, club, or school program, then Sport Yogi has a discounted offer that brings the Sport Yogi app to your squads and provides the boost in well-being and performance that you could be looking for. For teams and clubs, head over to sportyogi.com/teams. And for schools, head over to sportyogi.com/schools. Thanks for listening to the Raising Your Game podcast. You can find out more at lewishatchett.com or head to Instagram at lewishatchett or even head over to YouTube. If you found this podcast useful, then please do feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Simply head to Apple Podcasts, find the show, scroll all the way to the bottom, leave your review, and it really does help. Anyway, I will see you next time.